Thank you. So what I'd like to tell you about then is exactly what is in the title. I'm going to talk about some work from a few years ago that I did with Olivia White and Creighton Thomas on bulk perturbations in disordered magnets. And then I'll tell you about some very recent unpublished work on boundary perturbations. And I want to thank the organizers for inviting me and for the people who've been here this week. I really enjoyed chatting with people and getting to know some people I haven't met before better. And because it's the end of the week, I guess I feel comfortable enough with people that I can tell you a slightly personal story. Okay. So I know somebody, and when they were a small child, they would come to me and they would say things like this. They would say, "A Tyrannosaurus rex is kind of like a Triceratops, but is kind of different." And how can you argue with that, right? So, but what's interesting is the story goes on, because a few hours later, this person would come up to me and say, "A Tyrannosaurus rex is kind of like an automobile or a car, but is kind of different. They both move, they're both large." You can see some of the similarities. So what I'd like to address in this, at least start to talk about in this talk today, is a related proposal or a related type of statement, which is granular materials, disordered solids, the study of those is kind of like the study of spin glasses, but is kind of different. And what I'd like to think about is to say, well, is this a car or is this a Triceratops? Okay, so phrased a little more conventionally, how universal is complex behavior? When you compare systems where the disorder is due to a preparation or some sort of, or whether it's quenched disorder, like is it a history-dependent packing of granular materials or is it quenched built-in disorder? Is it out of equilibrium or are you optimal and equilibrated? And there are all kinds of questions that arise when you start to compare these things in this way. Things about memory, we heard about colloidal systems earlier this week. They're very interesting in the models of van der Waals interacting particles in terms of exhibiting memory. Those phenomena are also present in spin glasses. Avalanches, response to bulk perturbations and boundary perturbations. Generally, what is the landscape and what can we learn about the landscapes by pushing on these things at the boundaries in the interior and trying different response functions and very nonlinear type of response functions. So what I would start then is I'll tell you a little bit about some older work, but I think some of you may have seen it, but most of you probably haven't, which is about memory under quenched bulk perturbations. Where's the incoherent pointer? It's not the coherent pointer, the incoherent pointer, right? Okay, so here is some nice data that's been an example of some type of data that's been collected over the years for spin glasses. This is an out-of-phase magnetic susceptibility measured versus temperature. There's a very interesting temperature protocol here where you take the temperature and you lower. This is the temperature versus time. So you have this, this particular material, which is a spin glass, okay, and it just is, and you measure the susceptibility as you pause at different temperatures while you're cooling and when you heat it. And as you cool it and you pause here, you see the magnetic susceptibility, the out-of-phase magnetic susceptibility slowly decreases with time. That's called aging. Now you step down the temperature and it pops back up. That's called rejuvenation. You've removed some of the aging effect. But if you sit there for a while, it continues to decrease. And you can repeat that several times. You can age and rejuvenate, and so on, as you cool the sample down. Now, that's kind of cool. It's complicated. But now when you heat it up, what you see is very remarkable. When you heat it up at a constant rate, so you're not pausing, you're not letting any aging happen in the traditional sense by pausing at this particular point, you see dips in the magnetic response at the temperatures where you paused at on the way down. So this thing can remember what temperatures it's been exposed to in the past. And that's a very interesting type of hysteresis, non-equilibrium phenomenon, where it's just somehow encoded in this magnetic alloy that we'd like to try to understand a bit better. And so the way I'm going to approach this is motivated by that experimental work, is going to a very theoretical, numerical type of work, where we're trying to replicate these effects, because these things are very hard to replicate numerically. because they are such long time scale, non-equilibrium things. This is thousands of seconds compared to, you know, the terahertz or whatever, or more. There's a magnetic spin response time. So there's many decades of time scales here that you have to deal with. These are glassy materials. So I'm going to consider a two-dimensional disordered magnet with the standard energy Hamiltonian, which is just the sum over nearest neighbor pairs of Ising spins coupled by some JIJs. And I want to tell you in this talk about two types of distributions for those JIJs. One is going to be where you have a Gaussian disorder, but I'm going to tune the Gaussian disorder. If I set delta equals zero, this is just going to be some Kij, which is chosen with variance one and mean zero. And then there's going to be some K prime, which is going to be a perturbation of that Gaussian, but this combination is Gaussian if these are independent variables. So there's going to be these random Gaussian variables that are coupled neighboring spins, and these have random signs. So that's a frustrated system. They're competing interactions. Some of the spins want to line up in the same direction. Some of them want to line up in opposite directions. And delta is going to measure how far I'm tuned away from one of the disorders. And the other one is very simple. I'm going to look at a random bond model where the couplings have, they're ferromagnetic. They're not negative couplings, so the spins want to line up with each other. They lower the energies when the SIs are all uniform, either plus one or minus one, but they're going to be random in magnitude. Now, what I must tell you first about is the spin glass, and this is going to be the bulk perturbations. So in a spin glass, this is a picture of how the algorithm works. I want to give you a flavor of the algorithm. I'm not going to go into all the details. We've built up several approaches over the years, using different things. But this is kind of a mapping that was actually discovered by Castellane, and used by Michael Fisher and so on in the past, where you have, here's your spins that can be up or down. They are coupled by these red dotted lines here. I'm just showing four of them that are the bonds between neighboring spins. These are the JIJs that can be positive or negative in sign. And then you construct this dual lattice. It's a dual decorated lattice, which has bonds between spins and has these little gadgets here, which are completely connected sets of four points. And it turns out that any configuration of these spins can be mapped onto what's called a dimer matching. And a dimer matching is where you choose bonds that cover the points on this lattice. You cover all the points, but that's it. And I'm sorry, they just cover, that's what the matching is, it's a complete matching. And if you choose the matching, and what these matching points do is if you sketch together these longer bonds together, they indicate domain walls, regions where the spins are flipped. Because these bonds here are duals of, to the connections between the spins, and so a line of them actually forms a domain wall. So what it turns out then, so here's just a summary of what I said. I just want to tell it to you so that way you can just read this very quickly. These short bonds have zero cost, but these have costs that's given by the magnitude of the strength between, have cost JIJ, the neighboring spins that bonds that are dual to those. And then if you make the optimal complete matching, which it turns out you can do, what you do is you actually find negative weight loops. These negative weight loops lower the energy if you flip the spins inside of them. So you find these negative weight loops, and you find all the negative weight loops, which you can do. There are algorithms to do that quickly, and you find the ground state of the system. So I've told you a little bit of a complicated algorithm, but the idea is I want to just find the ground state of these complicated interacting spins in two dimensions. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the domain walls at zero temperature. So now I'm showing this on a triangular lattice with spins indicated by hexagons. Down spins and up spins have different colors in this picture. Here is a ground state. In a spin glass with random interactions, the ground state looks like white noise. The randomly chosen spins, if they have the same distribution as randomly chosen spins, even though they are an optimization, there actually is a minimum energy state. So some spins want to be lined up, some want to be opposite, and that resulting competition results in this complicated pattern. Now there is another ground state, which is flipping the spins. So if I take all the yellows and I turn them into greens, and all the greens and I turn them into yellows, or vice versa there, I create an opposite ground state. So in any finite system, there are two random-looking ground states. And then what we can do is we can describe an arbitrary configuration of spins by drawing domain walls. So here's an example of a domain wall in a spin glass, where on this side I have, actually I have A bar on this side, and I have A on this side. So I have a mix of A bar and A, and the line separating those is a domain wall. Now, those domain walls have been studied over time. And what I'm going to do is when I draw pictures, I'm actually not going to draw the spins. I'm going to draw the A and A bar regions for the spin glass. And those domain walls have been studied in detail. For people who haven't seen it before, I just want to remind you that we understand the scaling of the energies, numerically at least. There's some attempt to describe them through other means, like on Mingel-Katov approximation and so on, that are older things. And then there's a fractal dimension. That's important, that there's a fractal dimension for this domain wall. It wanders around a lot. It's not a self-affine object, it's a fractal object. Okay, so I want to tell you about domain walls because I want to show you an application of a very simple-minded type of algorithm, which is we use to study the system, which is patchwork dynamics. So here's some configuration of spins, up spins and down spins. And what we do is a very simple heuristic again. We pick some region of spins. We pull that out of the system. We copy it into some array in our code. And we keep the boundary spins fixed. So this is just a copy of this. And we bring along the boundary spins. Except what we're going to do is we're going to look at those spins and we're going to optimize them. That is, we're going to pick a new configuration where, subject to these boundaries, this is the best possible choice of spins on the interior. And we can do that very rapidly with the algorithms we have available. And then once we optimize it, it's pretty natural to take those spins and just replace them in the original lattice, and you have a new configuration. So it's just local optimization on a particular scale. The reason we're doing this is because the dynamics is very slow. So if we did the dynamics directly, like flipping single spins randomly, it'd take forever to equilibrate. So what we do is we do a multi-scale type of equilibration where we pick patches of spins at different scales and optimize those spins and try to see how things evolve with length scale rather than evolving with time scale. So there's actually an applet. I hope it still works. It's a little bit old Java. I tried it out the other day. It still works. But you can see this in action. And here's some results. So the idea here is this is some configuration where I'm showing the A and the A bar phase. And what I've done is just picked all spins over and over randomly, individual spins, and optimized those spins. And this is what you see after some time. It's a very fine-grained type of pattern. But as you increase the size of the patches up here up to the patch size of 8, you see that you coarsen the system. And you create A and A bar regions, where in those regions the spins are very happy, but they're separated by domain walls with some low energy. Okay, you can do the same thing with the random. So I've been talking about the spin glass. In the next part of the talk, I'm going to get to the random bond magnet, so I wanted to show this to you here. It's a little bit different in the random bond magnet, which is a very interesting thing. If you coarsen on some scale, you actually make domains that are larger than your patch size scale. Because it turns out that because the domain walls are not fractal for the random bond magnet, it's hard to make them turn. In some sense, you don't like to have small droplets. And so you can actually figure out kind of the maximum curvature that you can have for locally optimal solutions. And it turns out that these, we can predict the scaling of those, but it turns out that the droplets here, the domain regions, grow faster than the size of the patches, which is kind of interesting. Okay. Any questions about this so far? Yes, Jim?
Is this picture
to convergence? Right. Thank you for reminding me, Jim. So Jim's asking a question about convergence. And the thing is, you hit the patch, if you pick a fixed patch size and you hit them randomly, you will approach a fixed configuration. It's been proven by Newman and Stein, actually, that effectively the disorder pins the system and you will converge. So there's no question of in pure systems, you can have oscillations and fluctuations and so on. In these random systems, you can't. No, it gets stuck in, this is a stuck metal state. This is it. So this is, after I apply four, if I keep on hitting it by four patches, nothing will happen anymore. It gets stuck. So I've really chosen to equilibrate it at that length scale. Okay, so what I need to tell you just a little bit about briefly as chaos, because this is something that comes up in disordered systems. And you know, I don't know how much, I feel a little ignorant about how much this is known about what goes on in granular materials and so on. But the point is if, you know, this goes back some time, the idea is if you make some changes in global properties, like you change the temperature a little bit, or you change the strength of the disorder in the bonds, you will change the optimal configuration. You change the ground state configuration, or you can change the free energy and so on like this. I'll give you an example of this. It's a little complicated, but just to give you an idea that you can actually measure these things, which we were able to do in two dimensions. There's some four-dimensional work where they can do so also. What this is the plot. This is a little bit off topic slightly, so excuse me. But it's in a thermal condition where you consider twisted and untwisted boundary conditions, you measure an energy difference. And what that does is it probes the system at long length scales. And you can see sometimes this energy difference is positive and sometimes it's negative. And the scale over which these free energy differences vary is the chaos temperature scale. And you can show that that actually works out quite well with Bray's and Moore's prediction about how these oscillations should happen in large systems. So essentially, the whole point I want to show you this for is you change the temperature from here to here, the global optimum changes on all scales. And so that's what I mean by chaos, is if you change the temperature just a little bit, the optimum changes. And that the reason that's so important is used as one of the explanations for this type of memory effect we were just talking about, and this rejuvenation and aging. So the idea is this. This is why I want to show this to you. If you sit at some temperature, you get some slow coarsening where you're growing domains of some phase, some spin glass phase, say, within some other phase. And that's what aging is. So this is one explanation. It's not necessarily the one that everyone agrees on, but this is the one I'm focusing on here. When you lower the temperature, because of chaos, if you change some global parameter, the ground state changes, or the low free energy state changes. And so that means you're no longer going towards the same equilibrium point anymore. And that's why you're rejuvenated, because your landscape has shifted. And your landscape has shifted, so you've been lifted up into a new type of dynamical state. And that's what the rejuvenation is. And then you lower temperature. Now then when you increase temperature, it turns out that memory is not fully erased, because when we're seeing at lower temperatures, the domains don't grow as fast. So you don't erase the domains that you built at higher temperature. And this is what leads to a memory effect. And kind of a way to visualize that is something like this. Here's a landscape. That's some picture of a mountain that's been stretched around or something like this. We did. And here's different points at high temperature, medium temperature, and low temperature. And what happens is as you cool, if this is kind of a local free energy minimum, at high temperatures, you cool, you lower the temperature, what happens is you start moving towards this new low free energy state. And then if you cool it again, you start moving towards some other low free energy state. And somehow, because of the fact that these things are organized by temperature, think of these as kind of almost radially, they're like circles emanating out from this one due to the type of landscape that there is when you go back up, when you warm it back up again, you have to follow a track back that kind of tracks the path that you came down. And that's why you have memory, because you've kind of built in this structure at these different temperature, at these different length scales at different temperatures. Okay. So it's a little bit of a complicated story. I want to just show you the numerical results. I want to show you just a result of a numerical experiment where we're trying to explore these ideas. We begin with some random spin state. Take that back. That's the ground state for a given Jij. So we have some couplings between the spins. We find the best possible configuration of spins on the whole size of the sample. And then we add disorder to J. So we perturb the J's, we perturb the couplings between the spins, we shake up the system a little bit. And then we grow patches, we apply the patch algorithm at some scale L2 in the second step. And then we can measure the overlap, we can see how much this new perturbed state at that scale overlaps, how much it overlaps with the initial state. We just take the dot product of the two configurations and normalize, and that gives us some overlap. Then we take out this disorder, so we turn back to the same couplings, and then we apply some patches at some other scale, L3. There are different protocols you could use here, but this is one way to look at things. And what I just want to show you is the result. This here is a ratio of Q3 over Q2, which is how much information you've recovered. And this is the ratio of the patch scale here compared with the chaos scale. And so that's the region, that's the distance over which things would be changed by this addition of this disorder. And it's does say, it's a little tricky to explain, but the idea is here, when you don't, when you have small patches in this last step, you don't recover your original configuration at all. But when you start to make the patches larger than the chaos scale, you recover the information. And the remarkable thing here is that there are very few spins and very few spin correlations that remain. So once you do this jumbling by perturbing the disorder and equilibrating it at some scale, you've really erased a lot of spins. There are only a very few spins that still have their same position. And then when you grow the system back out again, when you remove the perturbation to the disorder, you try to grow coarse in again, it turns out that those few spins are enough to really recover most of the original information, the state of the system. Okay. Good. I have a slightly shorter story to tell you about controllability by boundary conditions, and this is this most recent work. And what it's motivated by is that these things are complicated. The thermodynamic limit in disordered matter is complicated. If you look at the correlation what does a thermodynamic limit mean? It means you have some system, you take the boundaries out to infinity, what happens to the interior? Do you see nice, well-defined, local specific heats, magnetizations, things like this? You know, you have a big system, you look at the interior, does it look like it's an infinite system? And when you have disorder around, these questions become very subtle, and there's been a lot of attention paid to them. In particular, if you think of a ferromagnet where all the spins want to line up with each other, and you add more spins to the outside, there's a very natural set of boundary conditions where you limit, like you have up spin boundary conditions, you have down spin boundary conditions on the boundary. But as you grow these disordered systems, what is a natural boundary condition changes with scale. And so there's an infinite sequence of possible changes in boundary conditions that might make sense. So you have to really look at all possible boundary conditions to see whether you have the correct thermodynamic limit or not. So what you really want to do is you want to have a system and make it larger and larger, consider all possible boundary conditions, and ask what happens to the interior. Now that sounds a little abstract, and it is, but it's connected to some of these questions about boundary perturbations in disordered materials. I mean, it's somewhat similar to it. So how do you check, if you have an L by L square, say, how do you check 2 to the 4 L boundary conditions? And the first step is something that was, I think it's a fairly intuitive, but it's not trivial to prove result that was shown by the student working with me right now, Sean Sweeney, is let's consider an arbitrary set of boundary conditions on some magnet. In this case, we're looking at random bond magnets, so they're ferromagnetic combinations. And it turns out that if I put some pluses and minuses around the boundary, because that's what I want to do, I want to put pluses and minuses around the boundary, I want to ask what happens on the interior. And so if I find the lowest energy state with a particular set of boundary conditions, maybe this is what it looks like. What you can do is you can show that that really is a sum of all these different domain walls. That if I find this particular boundary, for this choice of boundary conditions, I find this ground state, then that means if I changed all these spins to minus over here, like here, and all the to plus over here, then I would get the same domain wall. That the domain walls are decomposable. They don't interact in some sense. They because it's kind of a crossing of the domain walls that doesn't allow that to happen. It's because you have a positive surface tension in some sense in the system. Sorry? That's an interesting question. Is it special to Ising? I mean, it's easy to see how to decompose the boundary conditions in the Ising. If you have something like a spin, you know, a vector spin model, it seems hard. Then you'd have long wavelength type of things that I think would make it less clear. So what that means is we don't have to look at all 2 to the 4 L boundary conditions. We only have to look at pairs of points where we have a domain wall that starts at one point and ends at another point. So you only need all two ended domain walls, but still a lot of paths. Yeah, that's correct. It's something like L cubed computations and F steps that you need. But we've borrowed some stuff we found from some computer scientists that actually allow us to reduce that by a great factor. So it basically scales as the number of spins. We can examine all the ground states with different boundary conditions. So we could do 1,000,000 samples, 2048 squared in a day. I guess that's something like some tens of terapaths we can do in a day. It gives us some petapoints on paths, if you like. Let me show you an example of the results of that, what we found. So this is something that is kind of been looked at before, but this is a reproduction of it. So these are kind of shortest paths on a single sample. So what we do here is you consider a point right here, and you say, well, I want to make a domain wall that starts here and ends here. And so boundary conditions are plus here and minus around here, and that traces out some domain wall. And it's not straight because of the disorder in the system. This is just the shortest path problem. This came up earlier when people were talking about several times this week when people were talking about global optimum paths. It's a directed polymer problem. It's the same universality class, at least it appears to be. And it's something that we know the exponents for is the shapes of these different paths. But here's an example for a kind of a standard calculation on a 512 squared lattice. And here's a result. Now what I'd like to do, though, is I'd like to compare, well, what if I started a path here and went across, and a path here and went across, and so on. I considered all possible domain walls that could crisscross the system. Why does it have a tree structure? Actually, the computer scientists study something called shortest path trees. You can show that there are no loops, right? So there's a similar kind of, it's kind of the same reason that the domain walls are decomposable. You can't have crossings of the paths. That if you did that, it would be better to just kind of go the other way in the first place, because you don't gain anything by crossing. That's different in spin glasses, which is unfortunate. So here are a set of domain wall paths. Now what I've done here is I've shown all paths that cross the system, and I've color-coded them by their origin and destination. So there's some tree, say, that starts here and goes across the system. Well, here, like, let's just pick a point here. This is blue, roughly blue. That means it's connecting mostly paths that start over here and end up over here. So those are roughly vertical paths. Paths that are kind of reddish start here and end here. Now, you see they're not quite red because, you know, maybe they're a mix. You know, there might be a whole set of origins over here. We start out paths, and they coalesce, and they form this kind of, you know, they all share the same thing along here until they split out again. Regions that are white are kind of hubs where you have many paths from different directions crossing each other. So this is the type of thing where there's just a way to visualize the set of data we have, because we have a very large set of data on all of these things. But what one's interested in is really how does the density depend upon the distance from the edge? So what we know from like these optimal path types of arguments, we know that these paths wander as you cross the system by the length of the path to the 2/3 power. We have, if you think about a little bit about this tree structure, it's very important to calculating these exponents. You see that they're about L over L, because the boundary is size L. The paths cross at length scale L to the 2/3. So that means that there's kind of a natural number, which is L to the 1/3, that gives you the density of the paths in the center of the sample. And so once you start looking, great, thanks, Craig. Once you start looking, we pick points that come along in the vertical and horizontal directions, say, and we measure at distance r from the boundary, what's the probability of you running into a path at that location. And not too surprisingly, but it's nice to see, is that if you then collapse that data by looking at the probability how it depends upon the distance from the boundary, scaled with the size of the system for many different system sizes, you see that they collapse quite well with an exponent of about 0.36. We expect 0.33, but this is kind of within the systematic errors of what we're doing. you see that there's a large probability, a high density pass at the boundary. But you don't have to go very far in. It's kind of surprising. I was kind of surprised at how quickly it dies off. This function dies off as you go into the interior for the density of pass, and flattens out fairly well. So, you know, blowing up at the end of that curve, you see that there it flattens out quite well. The scaling collapse, if you zoom in on that tail end of the curve over there, works pretty well. And it tells you the size of those regions that are in the center. Scale is roughly the size of the system to the 2 chi power. So what we have here is we have a new algorithm for exploring these types of questions. We're trying to use it to do things like address unique to the thermodynamic limit, but also just really understand how these disordered systems respond to boundary perturbations. I mean, I think that's the connection there. You know, to get a window of size W in here, you need some size of the system that goes as W cubed. You know, so for example, if you wanted to hide something in the center of the United States, some facility, and everyone crossed the United States by taking the shortest routes across the U.S., you could hide something that was the cube root of the distance across the U.S., and no one would ever see it as they drove across. Yes, exactly. So we can calculate the area of Area 51, right? Okay. Okay. So I have a shameless plug here for some stuff here that does this type of calculation at finite temperature for spin glasses, where you can download and calculate precision functions. This is some recent work where we generate different thermal samples for this disordered system and look at the overlaps. So here we've generated 6 different Ising configurations at low temperature, and we can see these large excitations by comparing them and measuring the overlap of them. But again, that's just based upon a lot of work over the years in terms of understanding matching and sampling problems, especially by David Wilson. Gave us some great algorithm, you know, ideas for algorithms for how to apply this to the Ising model. So here's the time for lunch slide. What I've told you about is some about memory effects by doing bulk perturbation in these disordered spin systems, where we change the local disorder, we rattle the system a little bit, we make it shake it a little bit so it changes, and then we measure the low, you know, what happens to the equilibrium configurations in that case rather than the non-equilibrium configurations. I still don't understand really well how and where memory is stored in these systems. You know, and the question is if you compare with things like colloidal systems and so on, is you know, are there multi-scale here? We really have a picture that's built upon multiple scales. Are those multiple scales important for memory in other type of like granular systems and so on? And another thing is as opposed to bulk, is the controllability of the interior of a sample by applying forces or you know, twisting the boundary conditions at the edge of the sample. And we've been able to, you know, really fully explore this random bond magnet example, and we'd like to try it for other types of disorder. So thanks very much for your attention.
Presentation.
Thank you.
In your spin glass study, can you predict the spin glass phase transformation as a function of temperature? Would that be possible?
Right. So you're asking an interesting question. I left this out of my talk intentionally. Is in two dimensions, the spin glass temperature is at zero. And so there are other things, actually, I take it back. There are some things you can't control, though. You can look at zero temperature transitions. You can use this algorithm to study that. So people have done that where suppose you transition from random, you start mixing more and more ferromagnetic bonds. And so at some point you expect the ground state to become uniform or nearly uniform. And there is a transition there that people have studied well. So you can study some phase transitions with these types of models. The finite temperature one is an interesting subtlety in that at low enough temperature, it looks like you're in a spin glass phase, but there's no true phase transition at low temperature in the 2D case. But there are other types of transitions, zero temperature transitions, that you can look at.
The reason we are interested in this, because as Professor Damon mentioned, we are studying the high entropy error. It's a multi-component error with a composition between 5 to 35%.
Right.
We actually see spin glass transition at low temperatures. So the question is that can we predict that kind of behavior?
Right, so you're asking about spin transitions in alloys or three-dimensional systems, things with even like long-range order that might be more mean field-like and so on like that. And I think the part of the story where I can contribute there with this type of work is that here's a polynomial time algorithm where I can solve things very thoroughly and learn a lot about the types of questions one can ask and study if one had a better model algorithm for three dimensions. And so you can really see what the limits and also what the possible things you can learn are from these types of simulations, and also to try to test some heuristic approaches in different contexts, like different dimensionalities, like some of these genetic algorithms I think are very promising for that type of thing.
Thank you.
So granular materials, you yank on the boundaries, and they move around. And do you have any just speculations about memory effects or things you could look for in granular materials or algorithms that might be able to make predictions? I mean, it's out of equilibrium. It's not finding the optimum.
Right.
It's getting stuck somewhere.
Right. Right, so it's again, you know, is it an automobile or is it, you know, so I think there's some things you can learn. You can do some, so this patch type of work, I think, is something I think that's been thought about a bit in terms of granular materials, in terms of trying, you know, looking at different scales and trying to see the connectivity and the rigidity on different scales. So I think that type of same approach, there's some connection there that I don't know how deep it is, but they certainly look similar. And, you know, I've talked to people about that over the years. In terms of course, I mean, the point is the granular materials are not equilibrium, but the thing is maybe if you have something that's not equilibrium, but then you're looking at, like, sound modes or something like this, then maybe these types of ideas might be important. I don't know the answers to this. I mean, other people in this room may know, have suggestions or ideas about whether it will work or not work. I think it's something we're still working on. I mean, probably been working on for a while, but I think there is some promise.
So imagine that if I am driving a front with the boundary conditions, with what you have here, you can really study the statistic of the avalanches, right, at zero temperature.
If you were to move, like, the boundary conditions around, they would look like,
yes,
like avalanches.
Half minus, and I just move the separation between plus and minus. And
yes,
plus
yes, minus. That would be like an avalanche, absolutely.
And so with this, the scaling that you showed for the size of the domains at the center,
right,
is related to the size of the avalanches.
Right. Okay, but this is, as you know, like Pierre was, I think, emphasizing and so on. This, what I'm looking at is a little bit different because they're not dynamical avalanches, they're equilibrium avalanches. In the sense that you change the boundary condition a little bit, you move from one equilibrium state to another, you're not worried about the dynamics of how you get from A to B. Which, you know, people have looked at and so on, but it's a different question than a dynamic type of avalanche. Right, and so they look similar, right? They definitely look similar. So there's some similarities, but they're not exactly the same thing, at least technically.
I thought they're very different physically.
Right.
But they're in the same universality class.
They look to have very similar exponents for those types of distribution. And scaling functions, okay.
It's debated.
And it's debated. Okay, for the record, it's debated.
Did I understand you well that you explained the memory in the spin glass is, as being possible because the length scales at different temperatures are quite different, and so you can store memory at different length scales? Is that just a scenario, or is that more or less confirmed, or is this a necessary or just a sufficient condition to have this memory?
So there's been a great debate about what really matters in experiments of true spin glass. And I think that, you know, I think that's a little bit open. For what happens in the models, then I think you are also in the regime of controversy. I think, you know, what I explained is a droplet picture is something that's accepted by a number of people and is not accepted by others. I think it makes great sense. I don't see what the difficulty is with it. But I think the thing is there hasn't been, I think it's a kind of a phenomenological picture, it makes sense. Like you're saying, these different length scales at different temperatures, so you can burn in memories at different length scales and then recover them by increasing the temperature, makes good sense. The numerics are really hard, and that's what we're trying to do by looking at this particular model. And so we got it for varying for the bond strengths, but people will say that, well, you're not looking at temperature variations. We believe that bond variations and temperature variations should be in the same universality class. But so, I'd like to do it with temperature as well. I haven't gotten to there yet. There have been some simulations which see it, in three or four dimensional systems. But again, it's not really fully explored yet. I don't think it's conclusive numerically. That's one of the reasons I raise it. Yeah.
Okay, so any other questions? All right, if not, let's thank Alan again. And we meet back here at 2 p.m. after lunch.